everyone, and welcome to episode 35 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. It seems it's always the things that we take for granted that have the biggest impact on our lives and culture, the things that are so common they become almost invisible. One of these things is the way we measure. This week, I had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Emanuele Lulli, author of The Making of Measure and The Promise of Sameness. Emanuele is an assistant professor of art history at Stanford University and has been researching medieval measurement for the past 10 years, as well as contributing to The Guardian and Vogue Italia. Here's our conversation on how medieval people measured, what they measured, and how measurements themselves could be a devotional tool. Well, thank you for joining me to talk about measurement today. I'm really happy to have you. This book was eye-opening for me in that I'm one of these people that didn't really think about measurement before. So how did you get to write a book about measurement?
So first of all, thank you for having me. I'm so pleased to speak to you about the very hot topic of medieval measurements. So the idea of the book and of my research in general came out of an awareness that there's nothing about this type of material. So I was trained in New York, where I did my PhD, as a fairly conventional medievalist. I was studying medieval cities, so I was studying medieval space, medieval architecture, churches, basilica, squares, and so on. And I just wanted to know how these people were producing this space, you know, what kind of tools they were using to literally carve squares out of the densely populated space of the medieval city. And I kept looking to try to find out just like, you know, the most basic tools, like what kind of measurements they were using. And lots of authors could tell me what measurements they were using, what kind of standards they're using, the name that the standard had, but not how long it was, where it was preserved, you know, some of the kind of nitty-gritty of the topic. And I remember my supervisor, whose name is Marvin Trachtenberg, who's a very important professor of architectural history, told me, Emanuele, when you don't find a book you're looking for, it's time to start writing it. And that's exactly what I did. So I started digging the archives in Italy, in France, but mostly Italy, Northern Italy, and tried to find for any piece of information that I could find about medieval measurements. The research took more than 10 years, and this book is just the result.
Wow. It's important, like you say, because measurement is kind of the foundation of the economy. Everything is getting measured. So what, for example, what kind of things do they need to measure in the medieval world that they need to standardize? What kind of stuff were they measuring?
What were they not measuring? I mean, they were measuring everything, you know. When you went to the market, you know, you would just buy produce by weight, never by number, really by weight, mostly by capacity, by volume, and by weight. And so, no, they didn't come with kind of pre-standardized packaging, right? So the market is the first place where you need to measure literally anything. But they would measure the width of the streets, architectural elements. They would also measure the capacity of rivers, you know, how much water pits could contain, right? And when you start looking at measuring in the medieval world, you soon realize that measuring was everywhere. And it was a concern. It wasn't just something that was kind of like given, right? It was not something that everyone was kind of like at peace with. You realize that people were actually anxious about measuring because, as I say in the book, measuring was far from being the standardized, invisible practice that we regarded like today. It was a problem. So this book is constructed around the problem of measuring in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, when you think about measurement, like you say, it seems invisible. It seems like something that is just a given. We've always used these certain measurements. They've always been the same. And that's just how it is. It's like you say in the book that it seems like it's a natural thing, but it's not. It's completely constructed. So how did they construct these measurements?
Right. Yeah, actually, I found two questions in a very interesting point. And the first one is this super important point, which is, why do we think the measurements are natural, right? So even if this book is about the Middle Ages, I thought that I had to start by talking about when this idea that measurements are natural kind of came about, you know. And it happened in the 18th century, where basically the 18th century is the century where all the measurements that we still use today are, you know, been employed. The metric system in the most part of the world, the imperial system, a variation of which is still employed in the United States. And so at that time, those measurements were picking for particular discourses about freedom, about democracy, about equality that were produced at that particular time. And somehow the idea that we have measurements start in the 18th century. So the book starts with this kind of like short introduction in the 18th century to try to dismantle this idea. Because this idea is a response to a lot of the problems that people encountered in the Middle Ages, right? So the interesting thing for me is like, how can you come up with measurement standards in a world that doesn't know standardization, right? A world that doesn't know printing, that doesn't know like plastic, you know, any of that. And the story I tell in this book is that the medieval way to standardize measurement is the most ingenious of them all. So we think about measurements sometimes as like metal bars, right? If you go into like the departments of weights and measurements in every country in the world, there is a safe and inside there is like a weight and a length, right? And usually made of iron of like all different types of materials and leagues. But of course you couldn't do that in the Middle Ages because a metal bar would be weathered, it could be lost, could be stolen. You know, in the Middle Ages, they steal anything. They steal they steal any sort of weapons, they steal sculptures. And, you know, when there's a war, it's total madness, right? So the basic unit for your economy and for your justice needs to be made in something that cannot be, that cannot disappear, right? And the idea they come up with is to construct them in the negative. That is to carve usually the wall of the of their most important building, such as the city hall or the cathedral, and to inside the measurements in the wall, in the fabric of the building. And this method is so ingenious that we still have a lot of these measurement standards that have been preserved up to our day. And that's what I find it fascinating. We still have these measurements. It's just that no one pays attention to them.
Yes, and you have examples of that in the book. So these are literally measurements that were set in stone. So you've carved in, so you'd put your measuring tool in that slot. And if it fit, it was correct. That's how it worked, right?
Yeah. So the original standard is carved in the wall, right? But then there are all these kind of like copies. They're usually made of wood or metal, right? And the way to check if they're accurate, you literally just insert them in the rut. And if they fit, and sometimes in the incision, there are some sort of metal bits. So to make sure that people are actually not tampering with it, or if you have to substitute the kind of like stone slabs that you do it accurately and so on. Anyway, so if it fits perfectly, then you're good to go. And in the book, I compare this way of proceeding to Cinderella's shoe.
That's right.
Right? So, and this, I think, it comes from the Middle Ages. And I've got a whole little sort of like narrative within the book to show how the Cinderella story has evolved out of these medieval practices of measuring. But basically it's this. If you want to make sure that something is correct, you just have to fit it inside a mold, which is exactly what Perrault wrote in the Cinderella story.
Yeah, that's right. And when I was looking at these, there are pictures of these stones that have measurements in them. And I was picturing mostly that you'd put lengths. So a rod that measures in length. But there's actually some pictures of a brick form as well, aren't there? So you'd fit your brick in there. And if it fit, then it was the right measurement for a brick as well.
Absolutely. In Padua, in northern Italy, there is the shape of a bread loaf. And we probably have lost a lot of them, but this system is so ingenious and works so well that then decided they can standardize anything. So they've got various types of measurements. And one of the interesting things about the Middle Ages is that each unit is homogeneous to the material it needs to measure. So you have a rod for silk, a rod for cloth, right? But you have also a rod for wood or one to measure like immaterial space, right? Such as the distance between buildings. So you got all these different types of measurements and you put them all on the facade of your cathedral, right? Or of your city hall. and together with the bread loaf or the brick or the roof tile. And sometimes some of the displays are actually just beautiful to look at. And that's one of the things I hope the readers of this book will appreciate, that these are not just like ingenious ways to preserve standards. These become also beautiful, exciting objects to study.
Yeah. And I think if I saw one on the side of a building, I would have no idea what it was. And you mentioned in the book that people don't know what these things are. And when you figure out what they are, it's really exciting.
Right. I'm so glad you think like that. But wait, the book mostly focuses on Italy, just because I have to contain the geographical scope of the book. But you find them in France, I found them in Germany, you found them throughout the Netherlands and Belgium, you find them in Spain, you found them in Turkey, you even found them in the Roman world. And in fact, there's a bit of the discussions whether these strategies come from the Roman world, right? But I don't want to overemphasize that, because it seems that the Middle Ages then are just like ray trading something was there, whereas that's not true. The Middle Ages kind of perfect this system and they take it to completely new levels.
Yes. And I think that Italy is a good example, especially because you have the Italian city-states that are trading all over the place. So you have, for example, Venetian measurements all over the place. And you have to know the difference, because they're not the same from city to city, are they?
No, they're not. You're right. And that's exactly why they're so important, right? And so medieval traders and merchants, when they get to a new harbor, they need to know where the measurements are. And then they need to know that they've not been fooled by the local traders, right? So there's a whole system, like an institutional system there in place to guarantee that trade there is just and safe. And some cities are better than others at doing that. So you find also this kind of disparities in the medieval world between the cities that are really thinking hard about how to preserve their measurements and they're effective to do so, and cities that are a little sloppier, let's say. And maybe that also played a role in why they've not become the economic powers of cities such as Venice or Florence, right?
Yeah, and I think that's interesting where you mentioned that, you know, you go to a new city, you need to be able to find where the measurements are. And I had, it's something, again, I hadn't thought of, but you do need to make sure that you're not being cheated, that you have the right amount of material. And it is something that people kind of had to agree on together. One of the groups that you talk about is in Pisa. They elect 12 measurers and their whole job is to be measurers. So tell us a little bit about the measurers of Pisa.
Yeah, that was like a very interesting find, because Pisa is a very important harbor and basically is all projected towards the Mediterranean Sea. So all their money basically comes from trading with the Western Mediterranean and even some of the Eastern Mediterranean. So they need to think hard about this issue and they come up with something genius. So how can you, first of all, elect men that you can trust? So all the measurers are to be some sort of like well-respected men, usually male, but also they're usually, you know, people that have some sort of political authority within the city. So they own some estates, right? They're so-called boni homines in Latin, which means men of good standing, basically. So you got a poll, which is not very big, right? But also you want to make sure that everyone more or less knows how to measure. So you rotate them very quickly. Sometimes the pause lasts as little as like 2 months, which means that you got enough of a rotation to make sure that everyone is controlling everyone else. But because people are changing so quickly, you have to come up with an idea so these people get recognized. So they give them rings, for instance, so they can be identified in the market. And that's what one of the things they do in Pisa. But the most amazing thing they do in Pisa is that by law, they force them to stand in a particular spot of the market square and face a particular building. That when a merchant arrives, they say, I can see the crowd of 12 people just facing that building, and they can immediately spot them. They're not wearing uniforms like as policemen today. So they think to use space as a way to identify them. And then I was like, that's just like amazing.
That's right. And so you had to have trustworthy people who were going to be measuring. So you'd bring your stuff to them and they'd measure it for you. And then they had to be in agreement as well. It wasn't just one person measuring something. How many people had to agree that this was correct?
It varies from city to city. But one of the things that medieval people soon realize is that, you know, measuring is not like counting, right? In counting, you're dealing with discrete quantities, right? So 7 is 7. But when you're like putting, you know, a wooden rod next to a piece of cloth, where is exactly the end, right? It could be like a few millimeters more, a few millimeters less, right? You have to decide. And that's why one of the things I say in the book, and the book is called The Making of Measure and the Promise of Sameness, because measurement gives an illusion of sameness, but they don't produce the sameness because there's always someone that needs to decide at some point. They need to tell you that's where the rod ends, that's where empty space starts, right? So these people have to agree together. And I found a few cases. Sometimes it's like six people have to agree. Sometimes it's at least three. But it becomes interesting because sometimes these conversations have been recorded in the documents. So you get a real sense of how these people were talking at the time, what kind of issues they have. And one of the things I like the most, I found this novella, this short story written by a Florentine notary, which is actually a very well-known notary, and his collection of stories also well-studied. His name is Franco Sacchetti. And he creates a parody of how to measure, where no merchant agrees with another one how to measure, and they keep measuring fabric, and the fabric shrinks when it dies, expands when you cut it, and these people keep trying to like trick one another, and it's quite amazing. I think it just gives an idea of how shrewd and self-aware like medieval people were about this. The Middle Ages is always portrayed as this kind of like obscure dark age where people just didn't know any better. They're wrong. They were incredibly smart, and they were using all the tools and the materials they had at hand to solve everyday issues.
Yes, I absolutely agree. I mean, that's what the podcast is for, is to show this, how smart medieval people were and what they came up with. And one of the things that you talked about as well is sometimes people had to measure land, for example, and they had to resolve disputes with their neighbors. And so they had to have witnesses that were saying, I swear I saw this measured and it is correct. And this is where we can put the property line.
Totally. Absolutely. So yeah, first I give the example of cloth, but the biggest disputes are when it gets to land, and then you've got multiple notaries involved. And so I reconstruct one of those cases where you have multiple surveyors, but all the neighbors need to come to declare where a field ends and another one starts. And they have to go to multiple places, including to various churches, to swear in front of the saints, you know, and the patron saint of the city, that what they saw was correct. And that if they were found guilty of lying, they would pay a fine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's quite interesting also from the point of view of the socializations of these people, you know, kind of like the kind of system, the social systems that measurements produce at the time, you know, because one of the things I say in the book is that we think of measurements only as a tool, but it's actually part of the legal apparatus of these communities. And in fact, it's not by coincidence that a lot of the time these measurement tools were preserved in churches. They were not just as important, but were somehow almost like worshipped, like relics. You know, they had power. And sometimes you even have like the connections between saints and measurements is very, very strong, so that saints are the one that can measure better than anyone else. And in the book, I give a lot of examples of Dominican and Franciscan preachers that are very knowledgeable about measurements, but they also are in charge of measurements for the cities, but also a lot of miracles and a lot of magic that comes out of the use of measurements.
Yeah, and in iconography as well, you have measurement all the time, measuring souls and making sure they all measure up and things like that. You have some examples of that in the book as well, where they are measuring. And they, I think it's when the angels are actually handing the measurements to some Italian merchants, right?
Yeah. This is a famous fresco by Lorenzetti in Siena, and you have angels that are taking the measurements from heaven down, and they give them to kneeling merchants so they can, you know, carry on with their business.
That's right.
I mean, a powerful image.
Yeah, especially because it establishes it as being, this is the only measurement. It's the one that comes from heaven. You know, it's not something that we just agreed on one day. It comes directly from heaven, and it is correct.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of passages in the Bible where they're about measuring. At some point, I think I say that there are more occurrences of the word or of words like measuring than charity, right? So the Bible is very well, is a book about justice, right? And about how justice is kind of like handed down, not just from patriarchs to like, or the patriarchs, but also from directly from God, right? Because measurements are the ultimate tool of justice, right? So of course, God and the angels must be interested in it.
That's right. And it seems very objective when it comes to justice, right? This is something that we have all agreed on. It is beyond us. This is how it has to be.
Absolutely. And in fact, there's a lot of questions that I've tried to like explain in the book about how these two spheres sometimes are kept separated, like the secular world of law, like the city-state politics, and the religious spheres, how measuring somehow brings these two worlds together. And they kind of help one another, right? They both somehow sustain this idea that there is such a thing as justice, right? And that there is a sort of agreement and harmony between divine justice and the justice of man.
Yeah, and I like this connection that you're making between measurement and religion and this being important and revered in some ways, because I didn't know this until I read this book, but you were talking about a Genoese manuscript that tells you how tall Jesus was. And I've never come across this before, but apparently, so it's written out that this is the height of Jesus and that this person who's created the manuscript got it from a golden cross that was found in Constantinople. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
First of all, Jesus Christ is just as tall as I am. 6 feet.
He's 6 feet?
Yeah, it's just short.
Just short of 6 feet. Okay, now we know.
And the reason why I know is because there are lots of objects all around the Mediterranean that somehow reproduce the height of Christ. And every time there is something inside of the wall, or there's a beautiful big canopy in Rome where you can go under, right? And I just touch with the slab on the top of this kind of column, like with my head. So that's why I know about it. But a lot of these things are in manuscripts. And it's amazing because like there is usually a segment and then there's an inscription under it that says, take this segment and multiply 12 times or 6 times or 18 times, and you will obtain the correct height of our Lord Jesus Christ. So I reconstruct a little bit the story behind this. It's like, why people were so interested in the height of Christ? Why do they care in the first place? But the story is fascinating because it's a story about authority. Who can claim to know how tall Christ was? And a lot of this manuscript, the Genoese manuscript you refer to, by the way, great memory, and to the other various copies that I came across in the Mediterranean, they all refer to this very important relic, which is today gone, but it was basically in the sacristy of Hagia Sophia in Constantinople. And this object was said to have been made out of a cross that was produced in Jerusalem, and it was shaped after the height of Christ that he left. Sometimes it's on the column of the flagellation, but somehow related to the passion of Christ. So there's this kind of like chain of objects and legends that somehow map out where these objects are coming from. So somehow it's not just the measuring itself that matters, but it's also the story around it that matters. But the very fact that you end up with a segment somehow produces this idea that you were in contact with the real body of Christ. And that, you know, it was a massive devotion, and we forgot about it. And it was so big that even in the 1470s, you know, when Leonardo da Vinci was getting trained, in Florence, they still print out broadsheets that reproduce these measurements. And they become so famous that in Milan, then they do the same thing, right? So there was a public for this. And that's also what I try to show in the book, is that a medieval book somehow construct a very important devotion that is usually associated to the Renaissance. But the roots of this come from like the 9th and the 10th century. And that's what absolutely fascinates me about this.
So the story of this being the height of Christ, this is going back to the 10th century. Is it before that, or is it, that's kind of where you find it starts?
The relic in Hagia Sophia is dated around that time. There are other parts of Christ that measured before. And then we realize that every pilgrim that goes to Jerusalem already in the 4th and the 6th century, they're already taking measurements of everything they see. It's almost as if measurements proves that you've been in contact with these objects. You literally put your hands there. So I provide some of the evidence for this practice, but also show how these shapes the legends of the time. So for instance, there's a legend where the patron saint of Bologna, there's also the first bishop, goes to Jerusalem and with his rod measure everything there, and then he kind of reproduces everything else in Bologna. So the Bologna somehow becomes a double of Jerusalem thanks to the power of measuring. Because that's exactly what measuring does, and that's what is also codified in medieval books at the time. Measuring allows to overcome distances, bypass obstacles, you know, withstand time. It produces sort of connections and channels between people that have never seen each other, and even between, you know, the earth and heaven. So the measuring produces this, again, link with the invisible, with the ephemeral, and I find this absolutely fascinating.
Something that you mentioned when you were talking about the height of Christ, for example, was that people could reproduce that for themselves. And when they reproduce it for themselves, that could be a devotional activity. So you were talking about you might put notches on a wall and then you would be interacting with this height, or you might make a string of that length. And so this size actually became a measurement, I mean, a relic in itself, which is kind of interesting.
Absolutely. It totally becomes a relic. In fact, some of these texts even recommend to cut strings out of these segments and then just like tie them around your wrist or around your chest. And these ribbons take up apotropaic functions, which means they avert evil, right? And therefore, so these objects become relic, right? They kind of like scare demons. You can have them hanging in your house, so to protect your door, your threshold, right? So they're all these kind of strange, well, actually fascinating devotions out of measuring. So it, for me, it was fascinating because you think about the most sterile object ever, which is measuring, right? And then you find this kind of like rich textures of legends, ideas, practices, and inventions out of it. And I had great fun researching all this material.
Yeah, I remember when we were emailing back and forth, you were saying like, it seems like such a dry subject, but it's actually not. It informs so many things.
Right. And I hope with the book to have conveyed a little bit of this excitement, but it's true. The sort of traditional, mostly 19th century literature about medieval measurement is deadly. It's like thing you can imagine, like volumes and volumes where they tell you all the various cases we're finding. I mean, it's very useful material sometimes, but it lacks the emotional excitement that these objects had for the people. So with this book, I try to convey a little bit of the sense how these objects were used in everyday life, how they generated grand, ambitious ideas, how they brought families and communities together, how people fought for measurements, right? Or try to gain independence, like political independence, by creating your own measurements, how preachers like endorsed measurements as a way to curb the kind of personal interests of specific aristocratic families. So there's so much that the measurements open up, right?
Yeah, it's a very human history. And there are so many parts of it that I find surprising. Like, for example, there is a picture of one of the weights that was used as a measure. And it's a beautiful sculpture. And you had mentioned in this, like, not only is this a work of art, but also it's really difficult to forge because it is a sculpture. It's beautiful in itself. So tell us about that one.
Yeah, there's quite a few objects that are like wonderful. So for instance, we talked before about how standards tend to be in size in the walls, right? But that only works for flat objects or flat dimensions, right? So for tiles, for bread loaves, but mostly for lengths, right? But when you get the weight, they have to change strategy, right? So these have to be objects. And that's another strategy of like, how can you make them irreproducible? How can you make sure that people don't falsify them? Because if you end up having two weights, then you no longer know which one is the right one, right? So they asked the most important artists of the time to make them. So these are people that know how to cast in bronze, right? These are people who know how to carve beautifully, how to choose the right stone. So they make just terrific objects, right? Usually in very contorted positions. So the people would preserve them also for their aesthetic reasons, and they would venerate them also for the aesthetic qualities. So this is a case, but there are some others that are like, they are carved like gargoyles. There was a lot of pictures, you know, I've collected a lot of images over time, but I could only include a certain amount in the books. But, you know, there are like literally hundreds of these measurement standards in small local museums or in the open in most European cities. So, and there's still actually quite a lot I haven't written about at all, and probably that I don't even know about, right? Which is what makes it exciting. So if a lot of people want to continue doing research, they should all feel welcome.
Yeah. I mean, because this, you've opened the door for looking at all sorts of different things. And I like this when we're talking about sculptural objects being weights and stuff like that. I like this because, again, it talks about how do you solve a problem like this, because you need to be creative, you need to be ingenious, and they really were, which I thought was great. And speaking of being creative and ingenious, Peter and I were talking a couple of weeks ago about people stealing bread dough with a secret trap door so that they could steal it. There are lots of ways that people try to get around measurement standards. So what were some of the ones that you came across that you thought were good stories about how people tried to cheat the system?
Right. When you read the legislations of the cities, you find all the ways people were cheating. So, for instance, when people were measuring like grains, a lot of them were like tapping with your hands a lot on the container so that the grain would redistribute and level down so they could pile up on top even more grain, right? So some of the statutes of the city, they just say you can tap only once, or you can tap. I assume they tapped it very forcefully, right? You know, they were paying attention to this. So there were attempts by which they were trying to control the way people were measuring, which means that this is really like standardization. Measuring is not just about standardizing lengths and tools. It's also about standardizing practices, right? How you measure is like how much you stretch the fabric. And the legislation says you cannot stretch it too much, right? For instance, they say, every time you measure something, it has to be in front of the customer. You cannot measure in the back of your shop. Otherwise, we're going to fine you, right? And also the most important things, the tools had to be inspected every 6 months. So, you know, if you own a shop, you had to literally go to the tent where the measurer, you know, install himself, and the measure kind of like travels all around the territory, and every 6 months they come and they check. And sometimes they kind of skip every 6 months. There are occasions where the measure comes every couple of years. Everything's somehow well recorded, but then the measurer becomes responsible for it, right? So it's accountable for all these things. And the funny thing is that these system is also reproduced at a higher level. So it's usually the podestà, you know, in Italian cities, so basically the executive power that is in charge of the original measurement standards. And because they realize they get weathered and so on, they also say that every 6 months or every year, they have to substitute a slab if it's ruined or chipped or so on. So you can imagine like removing this big slab where there is the measurement, right? And insert a new one with a crisply outlined new standard. But they were going in great length to make sure that people somehow behaved fairly.
And I like how it's always in stories of the Middle Ages, it's always a committee. Like you always have to have several witnesses, like we were talking about earlier, because we don't always trust each other. There's always different ways to cheat.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, a lot of the times I'm talking about like kind of singular cases, but they're always committees. They're only like 6 people, 10 people. There are double copies of the same documents, like multiple times, right? So they're constant transcriptions. And this, however, also generates the issue, because every time you make a copy of something, every time you bring more people in, you increase the possibilities of error, because you increase the possibilities of disagreement. Or, you know, this happens a lot in manuscripts, right? The copies forgetting letters, or like entire paragraphs being important books. But the same is with measurements. You know, when you copy something by hand, you may lose something, or you may preserve it in a different way. So over time, the tool kind of changes shape, right? But exactly because of this, they try to keep an eye on these things, you know, more frequently, let's say, rather than less.
It's such an eye-opener to how society worked in a way that I don't think we see in many other books. And the more you look at it, the more it's like the Matrix, right? You see it everywhere. And all of a sudden, you see all the different ways in which people measured, they used it, and how it affected their, as you say, their day-to-day lives. So I'm so glad to talk to you about this today. So thanks so much for coming on.
for inviting me. That was amazing. I'm so pleased to reach like an audience of medievalists, because even if this is like an academic book, it's published by University of Chicago Press. I really try to write it so it doesn't read like an academic book. There are lots of stories, a lot of, let's say, of, you know, I always talk about the kind of evidence I have and when I have problems with, because sometimes not all the pieces of the puzzle perfectly fit. But I put a lot of the information, like a lot of the Latin, for instance, in the footnotes to try to kind of keep the main text quite light and pleasurable. So you kind of get more a sense of how people were using these things rather than all the problems of writing history. And I hope, you know, readers benefit from this kind of work, you know, at the level of writing rather than just at the level of the research.
Yeah, as you say, some of the previous works are super boring. This is an exceptional book in that it is very readable. And I think that's really going to change how people look at measurement in the Middle Ages. So great job. And thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the compliments. I'm humbled by them. But thank you so much for inviting me. It's such a pleasure.
It's mutual. To find out more about Emanuele and his work, you can visit his Stanford faculty page at art.stanford.edu/people/Emanuele Lulli. That's EmanueleLugli. His new book is The Making of Measure and the Promise of Sameness. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new, Peter?
Hey, Danielle. Yes, there was a big discovery last week in France of a Cimabue painting. He's this 13th century artist from Florence, kind of like a forerunner to the Renaissance. And it just happened that some family had like a piece of his sitting in their kitchen, and it's going to be worth probably about 6 million euros. So good on them.
Hanging over a hot plate, wasn't it?
Yeah. So it looks good. Looks good. So you can check it out. We got actually a pretty good news piece because it links off to all the specific sources about that painting. So check it out. We also have your piece on sports in medieval London. So if you want to know how to make a jousting tournament on water, you've got that there. And a piece that I really enjoy is collections of sayings and wisdom from the 9th century. I love this kind of stuff, so I always try and get that on the website. So if you want some advice on how to live life, check this out. My favorite one is that wishes are fulfilled by taking risks.
Oh, that's so true. That's very wise.
Yes. So we're all about wisdom here on medievalist.net.
That's for sure. Okay, thanks, Peter.
You're welcome.
Well, this is an exciting week for the podcast. On Thursday, we had our first book club meeting on Zoom for our Patreon book club, talking about the Sutton Hoo story. That video has been uploaded to patreon.com and is now available to all of our patrons at all levels. People in our book club and who signed up in September will soon be getting their new book, The Bayeux Tapestry, New Interpretations, courtesy of Boydell and Brewer. We'll be talking about that one on Zoom at the end of October, and I'm really looking forward to discussing it with you. If you're interested in joining our book club, check out our Patreon page. While you're there, you'll notice that there's something new. That's right, we've just added a new level. If you sign up for $3 per month, you can get what you've always wanted. You can read the desktop version of medievalist.net ad-free. So if you're one of those people who hates ads, you're in luck. You can get your favorite website ad-free and support your favorite podcast at the same time. It's win-win. For more information about your ad-free reading experience and our book club, visit patreon.com/medievalists. And finally, it's an exciting week for me because my book, Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, just came out on Monday in the United Kingdom, and a whole bunch of you lovely people seem to have cleaned out Amazon stock. But have no fear, you can still order it directly from Pen and Sword History at pen-and-sword.co.uk. For those of you who did pre-order, you have my eternal, most heartfelt gratitude. Thank you so much for supporting me, and I'm really hoping you enjoy the book. I haven't got my copies yet, so if you see it in your local bookstore, take a picture and tag me on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. For more medieval goodness, you can always follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. If you got a question for me directly, you can reach me at Danielle, that's D-A-N-I-E-L-E, at medievalists.net. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thank you for reading and for listening. Have yourself an immeasurably wonderful day.